Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Rayo versus BP Products North America. Mr. Ordower.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Peter Ordower, and I represent Salek Rao, the appellant. First, let me thank you for the opportunity to be here. It is an honor. I would like to begin by noting what the case is and is not. This is not a case about whether Mr. Rao was an honest man or not, whether he engaged in improper conduct or not. The only claims involved here are that BP Products violated federal law through the Petroleum Marketing Practices Act, and whether the as well as breach of contract, and whether the other defendants also participated in misconduct. I expect that Mr. Langdon will try and spend a good deal of time talking about Mr. Rao's activities and whether or not they were proper. I think that's essentially irrelevant to much of this case. Let me first address the issue of whether BP Products violated the PMPA through failing to timely exercise any right of termination it may have had. The parties agree, I believe, that at least with respect to the Forest Park Station, that Mr. Rao had a franchise that was governed by the PMPA. The parties agree, I believe, that pursuant to Section 2802B2A1 and C1, that the Act requires that in order to properly exercise any right of termination, the franchisor must act within 120 days of when the franchisor, and this is a quote, first acquired actual or constructive knowledge of the breach of any franchise agreement. And failure to comply with that notice, or that to act in that time period, waives the right of termination and creates a cause of action by the franchisee. The parties agree that the termination notices for both the Forest Park and Morton Grove stations were provided on July 14, 2004, and that those notices cited as the grounds for termination bribing the former employee, Stephen Yar, and assisting Paige Thomason in her acquisition of the Wilmette station in violation of BP policies. The appellee's brief at page 7, the beginning of it, I'd like to read one sentence of it, which is an admission, I think, which is that defendant appellee Steve Yar is a former employee of BP Products who was terminated on November 13, 2003 for his involvement with dealers, including Rao, in a bribery scheme against BP Products. So there's no question, I think, through that admission that BP knew about the bribery, knew that it involved Rao, and was sufficiently comfortable with knowledge of that at that time to fire Mr. Yar.
But in order to, by your argument, you're basically saying BP should have known that when Rao began cooperating, that basically he wasn't telling the truth when he went to BP and said he was the victim of extortion, because that's how he presented himself, as a victim of extortion. So couldn't BP have legitimately taken him at his word, and only when he stopped cooperating concluded he wasn't the victim as he first claimed, because he came in saying, I'm a victim?
I don't believe so. I think as the district court noted, and as BP noted in its brief, the passing of gratuities in order to influence an action of a corporation is improper, whether it's categorized as extortion or bribery. I think they knew at that time there was no question that it was against BP policy, that it violated the franchise agreement, and no matter how one characterized it in a self-serving manner, or in a confessional way, that at that time they knew that it constituted bribery, and that's exactly what they accused him of in terminating him It was actually 11 months later on an untimely basis.
But then if we buy into your interpretation, I mean, it's really a harsh rule because we would be discouraging companies from conducting investigations before ending franchises. It would be like if something came to their attention, boom, the 120-day clock begins to run. Isn't it a better policy to encourage an investigation before taking a significant step of ending a franchise?
I have no quarrel with the idea that certainly important property rights are at issue here, and BP should not act improvidently.
So you would say that the clock should start running right then, and then the clock should have run immediately, and then even as he was cooperating, time was running out, and he just should have been terminated. In other words, he'd have to make his pitch within that period.
No, Your Honor, I would not say that. I would say that the clock certainly ran in November of 2003, and the reason is that it was not simply a suspicion of bribery or wrongdoing by then. What we had was that in August 2003, Mr. Rao came forward and reported specifically the acts of giving the gratuities to Mr. Yar and the demands that had been made on him. By that time, that same month, Mr. Benhart, the security agent for BP, sufficiently understood the nature of those admissions that he enlisted the FBI at that time to assist with the investigation.
Zordar, would it be at all reasonable by BP to consider that there might have been circumstances extending beyond those two individuals? I'm not saying that there was, but how do we draw the bright line for us, or a reasonably bright line on when an investigation is concluded?
I don't think the investigation, well.
I mean, if it had concluded as to Mr. Rao, but was, or the presumptively had concluded as to him, but there were some individuals maybe connected with the other Mr. Yar, should a company have any flex in going past that time, I guess, is what I'm saying.
I think, with all due respect, Your Honor, the question is not when the investigation concludes, but under the statute, it is when the franchisor first acquired actual or constructive knowledge of the wrongdoing. And I think in this case, and I'm not espousing a general rule necessarily, but certainly this case presented as clear and as occasion of obvious wrongdoing that they knew about in November as could be, where they had, because after those events I've already described, on November 4th, Mr. Rao furnished BP with a 17-page statement in which he specifically identified giving payments to Mr. Yar for $10,000 in connection with the purchase of the Wilmette Station for Ms. Thomason. He admitted giving him a computer, a big-screen TV, a washer-dryer, tickets to concert and sporting events, and all kinds of other benefits on a very specific basis. I think at that point, certainly, there is where the participant himself is stating in writing and signing off on it that was definitely first knowledge by then of the wrongdoing. In addition, as the court is aware, only 3 days later, Mr. Rao participated voluntarily in an FBI sting, which caught Mr. Yar on tape receiving a bribe or receiving an unauthorized payment from Mr. Rao, and the FBI immediately apprehended him, received the $10,000 in marked cash. Mr. Yar then gave a written confession to the FBI within a few days. He led them to $137,000 in other cash, and then on top of that, Mr. Benhart then interviewed Mr. Yar himself about these facts at that point, and Mr. Yar admitted at that point that he had taken gifts of cash and merchandise from Mr. Rao and others in a bribery scheme, which is how Mr. Benhart described it. And within 10 days thereafter, they terminated Mr. Yar. So it's hard for me to imagine what other evidence they could be waiting for when they have an FBI surveillance tape catching a bribe in the act, when they have written confessions by both of the parties who are involved in it, where they have the cash that's been recovered from it. I don't know when they finished that investigation, but it sure began by then, and they sure had knowledge of it by then, and that's the starting point.
As you know, we obviously have to look at each case, but look at the next case down the line. It's part of the process. Suppose we have a franchisee who, under the statute, has a failure in the sense he does not follow the advertising policy of the company, or wearing uniforms or such, whatever it is. The company is aware of it, takes no action, and in that prescribed period. And then post that period, something evolves as is alleged here. Do we have a new time period starting? Are you precluded from looking at subsequent failures by a franchisee because of you're stopped by not having acted
I think if they didn't act within 120 days of learning of the advertising violation, that they would waive that. Obviously, if there were subsequent violations of any sort that were within 120 days.
What if the incident, the second incident, was began, it germinated in that earlier period? I'm just trying to see how we're going to parse this. In other words, can it be overlapping periods? What if they have suspicion of one wrongdoing and pretty serious?
I guess it's hard for me to separate in my mind what's a suspicion from what's a fact, but sort of like obscenity, we know when we see it. And I think in this case, there is certainly overwhelming evidence. And in fact, obviously, their brief talks about the lack of cooperation many months later as being the linchpin of when they decide to actually terminate him. And there is absolutely nothing in the statute or in the termination letters or in anything that talks about cooperation as being the key to when they have to act. And, in fact, it makes no sense at all because they already had all this other evidence, and lack of cooperation for whatever that means, which they never define, certainly doesn't prove anything more than what they had in November. And they admitted in testimony that throughout 2004, they never obtained any additional information about Mr. Rao's activities, which led to his termination.
It's your time, but I just wanted to alert you that you're into rebuttal.
Okay. I'm into rebuttal now?
Well, it's your time. You want to use it?
I'll wait for rebuttal. That's fine.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Ardauer. Mr. Langen?
May it please the Court. I'm Andrew Langen for the Appley BP Products. I have the other Appleys have reserved a little time as well. The district court should be affirmed in all respects. Mr. Rao was properly terminated for misconduct, bribery, and fraud, and the legal arguments we've heard today and in the brief are meritless. The first issue I'd like to point out is the record on appeal and what record that Judge Gottschall decided summary judgment on. And this is a classic case of the application of Rule 56.1. After a preliminary injunction hearing and an evidentiary hearing in which the Mr. Rao's application for a preliminary injunction was denied, with a lot of testimony, exhibits, and the like, shortly thereafter, BP answered the remaining claims in the complaint and moved for summary judgment and filed a Rule 56.1 statement in the district court. Mr. Rao, who was represented by counsel, did not file any contrary statement, and your honors are well aware of the operation of the rule. There's a long string of cases in this circuit about the consequences of that. And the district court proceeded to analyze summary judgment based upon a record that it deemed to be admitted based upon BP's Rule 56.1 statement. The district court just didn't willy-nilly enter summary judgment, however. It went through the legal issues point by point based upon the uncontested record and decided to enter a summary judgment. Now, here, Mr. Rao says that this court should do a de novo review of the entire record. Now, I respectfully submit that's not the law of this circuit. I think that the Johnson versus Cambridge case by Judge Wood gives a very detailed policy explanation as to why it is that a district court should not have to worry that if somebody fails to comply with the summary judgment rules in the trial court, that later on the appellant's going to get an opportunity to point the entire record to try to come up with a disputed fact. That opinion states that the district courts have been told repeatedly, you don't need to worry about that. What counts is what's in the Rule 56.1 statements, and we're not going to let people come in later and try to raise disputed issues of fact, which is what's going on here. And by the way, those rules have been enforced in cases involving single plaintiffs against corporations. They've been enforced involving race discrimination cases, ADA cases. Judge Flom, you were on a case called Amos versus Aramark, in which Rule 56.1 was enforced in an ADA case. And so the rule's well settled in this circuit that the record that you should look at is the Rule 56.1 record. As to the termination of Mr. Rao, he really doesn't dispute that the termination was proper. He says that it was untimely, but he doesn't dispute it was proper. First point I want to make about this is the whole 120-day issue, statute, only applies to the Franklin Park station and not to the Morton Grove station. We have established that the Morton Grove station is not subject to the PMPA because it does not meet the statutory definition of a franchise. It was a very different economic arrangement, something called a commission and marketer arrangement. And the important thing for present purposes is that under a commission marketer arrangement, Mr. Rao never actually purchased gasoline, never took title to gasoline. He operated a service station, but he never bought the gasoline, never owned the gasoline. And as a result of that, there were other terms that were different, too. He paid lower rent, things like that. But the significance is, and the commission marketer agreement says so on its face, a franchise under the PMPA doesn't arise in such a situation. And since the franchise agreement never arose under PMPA, the whole 120-day issue is irrelevant to the Morton Grove station. But even if it was relevant, the undisputed facts found by Judge Gottschall shows that our actions in terminating Mr. Rao were, in fact, timely. And Judge Williams, I think you were getting to some of the key issues in your questions of appellant's counsel. If you look at the facts that Judge Gottschall deemed were admitted, those facts included, and I'm quoting from Statement of Uncontested Facts 65, 66, and 67 at the Record on Appeal 149. They're the most important ones. BP learned of Mr. Yar's wrongdoing in late 2003, August, November of 2003. There's no doubt about it. Our investigation of Mr. Rao's exact role in this wrongdoing continued into 2004. Mr. Rao initially claimed, as Judge Williams indicated, that he was a victim of extortion as opposed to a participant in bribery. And we investigated that. We were also investigating other people that were involved with Mr. Yar as well. We gave Mr. Rao a chance to come forward with information to exonerate himself as this investigation continued. We simply didn't pull the trigger and terminate at the first rumor or innuendo. And if we look at the Nassau Boulevard case from the Second Circuit, which we believe is the leading case on this, it's clear that at least there the Second Circuit cautioned franchisors like BP to act with prudence and restraint, don't pull the trigger at the first suspicion of wrongdoing. And in this case, our investigation continued. We gave Mr. Rao an opportunity to step forward, and it wasn't until June 2004 when he refused to meet with us further and did not come forward with information as to why it was extortion and not bribery. It was then that our investigation unit consulted with our management, and our management in June 2004 then concluded that the grounds for termination existed, that Mr. Rao had in fact been involved in bribery, not just a victim of extortion, had been involved in the other conduct, including fraud, and we made a decision to terminate. And these are all undisputed facts in the Rule 56.1 record.
Now you certainly don't disagree that the company fired Yar in '03, November of '03.
No
there
dispute.
There were no new facts
no
uncovered,
dispute.
You know, after December of '03. No new facts as it relates. I mean, the big change.
That Mr. Yar was a bad guy and we terminated him. I agree. Undisputed.
That with Mr. Rao, no additional facts relating to him after December 2003, other than this change of his cooperation.
He also was claiming at that time that he was a victim of extortion, not bribery. Our investigation of Mr. Yar and Mr. Rao and others continued. And it was only until I agree there is testimony that no particular facts came to light. But one thing that also came to light was that his opportunity to come forward with information to exonerate himself and to prove to us it was just extortion, not bribery, he never did that. And it was only when he refused to keep meeting with us did our management reach the conclusion, you know, this is bribery. It's not just extortion. And I think, frankly, the company acted very responsibly in doing that. And I don't know how else you can have the 120-day period start running. For instance, in the Nassau Boulevard case, Shell was aware in May, I think it was 1988, that the franchisee there was involved in some kind of credit card improprieties. Shell decided not to pull the trigger to investigate, and it met face to face with the plaintiff there in July. And the Second Circuit held it was at that meeting when he was confronted with the information that the man finally admitted his wrongdoing. That's when the 120-day clock started running. In this case, I would submit the parallel is we asked for an opportunity to meet with Mr. Yar so he can present his information about why it is it's extortion, not bribery. He refuses to meet with us. I think in this case the 120 days starts running there. And Mr. Benhart testified, and it's undisputed, that that refusal did not occur to June 2004, which makes our July 14th termination decision easily within the 120 days. I've already talked about the fact that he wants a de novo review of these facts. I don't think that's proper under these courts' rules. I probably should touch on a couple of the other claims that have been raised. The breach of contract claims as to the Franklin Park Station, we believe they were clearly preempted and that Judge Gottschall properly held. It doesn't matter whether this court decides to adopt the so-called narrow or expansive view of preemption. Either way, this contract claim is preempted by the express statutory language in 15 U.S.C. 2806A because his contract claims relate to and are inconsistent with the proper grounds and termination under PNPA at the Franklin Park Station. I think the Clark case is the most important case on this point. I also want to touch on the motion to dismiss decision that Judge Gottschall made. She dismissed certain of the pleadings. She was correct in doing so. I also want to note the very important procedural fact that Mr. Rao and his counsel were given multiple opportunities to amend to cure some of the deficiencies that were identified, and they never did so. As to the RICO claim, which was count one of the complaint, much of that claim was clearly time-barred by the four-year statute of limitations. That conclusion is not challenged on appeal, and therefore any pre-September 2000 conduct should not even be considered. We also believe the rest of the RICO claim was properly dismissed. As to 1962A, Rao never properly alleged that any defendant received income from a pattern of racketeering activity, never alleged the defendant used or invested income, and never alleged that Rao's injury was caused by a defendant's use or investment of racketeering income. The Vicom case from this court, 1994, is the most important case in this regard. As to 1962C, Rao did not separately allege as to each defendant that a defendant, BP or otherwise, conducted an enterprise through a pattern of racketeering activity. In fact, if you go back and look at the complaint, about six different RICO theories or four different RICO theories against three different or four different defendants are all jumbled up into one claim for relief. Rao failed to allege properly who the enterprise was, failed to allege separateness between the enterprise and the defendants themselves. As this, as has been held in the Baker and the Reeves cases, a defendant must be a separate and distinct entity from the enterprise, and certainly as to BP, Rao failed to plead that. Furthermore, his boilerplate claims seeking to satisfy the RICO statute are simply not sufficient. But before my time is up, I also want to mention the fraud claim. There's been no appeal from Judge Gottschalk's ruling that pre-1999 conduct was barred by the statute of limitations. Furthermore, the fraud allegations were not pled with particularity under Rule 9b. The alleged fraud, according to the complaint, was based on future conduct, which is not actionable, and did not allege a false statement of material fact. And as I mentioned before, Rao had opportunities to amend and failed to do so. If I may sum up then, Mr. Rao is faced with a summary judgment ruling based on facts that he did not contest in the court below and which were deemed admitted. I would submit the lower courts can't function properly. If an appellant can fail to contest facts in the lower court and then ask this court for a de novo review, scurrying around for some possible disputed fact, this disposes of his claim that the termination came too late, and those same undisputed facts dispose of his other claims as well.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Gorman?
Good morning, Your Honor. Stephen Gorman on behalf of Stephen Yar. I think I reserve 2 minutes. I'll try not to use all of it. I join with Mr. Langan with respect to the deficiencies of the pleading as they relate to my client, Mr. Yar, specifically the RICO claims and the fraud claims. I would note to the court that in the briefs that have been filed by the appellant in this case, he cites not a single case, which not any case to suggest that the pleading that he filed with respect to RICO is adequate, and in his reply brief cites no case either to that effect or contesting any case that's been cited by the appellants with respect to the sufficiency of the RICO claim. The boilerplate allegations are simply not enough. This court has held that a number of times. The fact that he has alleged certain alleged conduct by Mr. Yar that could be extortion is not enough. With respect to the fraud claims, again, I would join with Mr. Langan. The allegations with respect to the supposed statements made by Mr. Yar, even if adequate under Rule 9b, do not establish fraudulent a case for fraud. They are at best statements of intent to take some conduct in the future, to take some act in the future. Mr. Rao had absolutely no basis to rely on such statements. He had leases, he had agreements, he had documents with BP that set forth his rights and obligations and the circumstances under which he could be terminated. And for all of those reasons, I would ask that on behalf of Mr. Yar that the decisions of the district court dismissing the RICO claims and dismissing the fraud claims be affirmed.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gorman. Ms. Cohen?
Good morning, Your Honors. Jeffrey Colin on behalf of the appellees Brad Schumacher and Ms. Thomason. I join in my co-counsel's arguments regarding the fraud and the RICO claims, which are the only claims that are pled against my clients. In addition to the things that they raised, I just also want to raise one other point, which is that after Judge Gottschall issued her ruling on the motion to dismiss, Mr. Rao was given an opportunity for leave to plead claims or replead his claims against my clients, and he failed to do so. I think that the opportunity to replead those claims and failing to do so bars any argument that those claims were properly pled. In the first instance, this was a case in which Judge Gottschall was exceedingly patient with the plaintiff, and his failure to do so, I believe, bars those claims. I did just want to read very briefly the allegation in the complaint, the fraud allegation, because I think it's illustrative of the conclusory nature of those claims. In paragraph 25, the allegation is that the actions of the defendants constitute fraud on their behalf against the plaintiff. There is no allegation of a fraudulent statement. He lumps all the defendants together, and I think the precedent in this court is very clear that district courts are correct to quickly reject such claims that stay so in a conclusory fashion. And therefore, we'd ask that you affirm the district court's ruling. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Golan. Mr. Ordower?
Your Honors, first I want to go back to the issue of the timeliness of the termination briefly. As I understood counsel's comments, he would suggest that the key factor in them deciding that he should be terminated was the fact that he wasn't meeting with them anymore, which has nothing to do with what they said was the grounds for termination.
And I don't think that he said that. He said that they were still investigating and giving him the benefit of the doubt until he failed to show up.
That's fine, but then that means the failure to show up, and that it is.
That's when they decided they would really look into whether or not they had grounds to fire him.
Right, and
they fired him within 120 days after that.
Well, first of all, I think that's really a conclusion on their part, because they have not specified anywhere what a cooperation he failed to provide.
Well, he failed to show up. You don't have to.
I don't think
go too
failing
deeply
to show
into
up.
What they failed to provide, he failed to provide, he didn't show up at all.
I think failing to show up means he didn't attend. It doesn't mean he committed
right,
bribery.
Right, but the whole point of him showing up was he had started out saying he was a victim of extortion. They gave him an invitation to come in and prove that. He didn't come in.
Your Honor, this...
So that's the problem. That's when they decided he's not a victim of extortion.
I don't think so.
He's the one doing the bribes.
We're talking about 7 or 8 months later.
Right.
And in the meantime, he gave them all of the information he had. He gave them written statements. I don't know what they were supposedly expecting him to do, saying everything that I said before was false. I mean, there's absolutely nothing that tips the scale with respect to his alleged silence after he's given them all this
during cooperation. During that period, Mr. Ordower, prior to June of 04, does the record reflect representations by Mr. Rao as to the status as a victim? I mean, I'm trying to get a sense of what transpired in the first half of 04, which would either justify BP's position or support yours.
I'm not aware of anything that happened in 04.
Does the record reflect that it suggests he did not want to meet after June, but had there been meetings before?
There had certainly been been meetings in 03.
Well, I understand.
I'm not aware of any meetings in 04. I'm not aware of them asking for any meetings.
Last contact. What would the record suggest about the last contact between your client and the corporation?
I think it was probably sometime in 04, but I don't think that there is any there was no evidence that he failed to do anything that they asked him to do.
I just want to first of all establish what the baseline is of what kind of contact is. You can then speak, of course, to the substance. But in 04, there's still contact, and is Mr. Rao presenting himself in a particular way in 04?
I think the record reflected some testimony that sometime in 04, Mr. Rao went to Pakistan. He came back. There was some interest. They made a phone call or something like that and invited him down. And at that point, he indicated that he wanted legal representation, and because he wanted to pursue his claims, and that forms part of the RICO and claims, that Amoco then said, essentially, if you do that, we're gonna terminate your franchises. If I can just briefly address some of the other points, I think I should. First, with respect to the record on appeal, as we said in our brief, there's absolutely nothing in the opinion at all that indicates that Judge Gottschall limited her opinion to looking at the facts set forth in the 56.1 statement. And, in fact, there are references to other exhibits which show otherwise. And the facts that we're relying on are all facts that BP presented to the court in support of its motion for summary judgment. So I think to say that we shouldn't look at those in determining whether summary judgment was proper or not makes no sense at all.
Mr. Arnold, are you going to speak to the Morton Grove station?
Yes. I think with respect to Morton Grove, the reason we say that that's covered by PMPA and that the termination was equally untimely there was because PMPA regulates termination of franchise relationships as well as franchises. And there's no because we are all in agreement that he had at that time a franchise at Forest Park as well as Morton Grove, and by terminating both of those stations together, they ended the franchise relationship, then I believe it falls within the ambit of the Act. There's one other point I would like to make just briefly, which is with respect to the breach of contract claim. I do think that's an important policy issue for the Seventh Circuit to decide in accordance with the majority of other circuits. And I would also point out with respect to this case in particular, that there are basically two wrongs that we said through the breach of contract. One of those was the failure to act in good faith on purchasers that Mr. Rao submitted for his stations. That kind of breach of contract can exist whether or not they're terminating him. And so I think clearly there is a basis for a breach of contract claim that does not intrude at all on termination rights or anything under the PMPA.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ardar.
Thank you.
Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to the second case of the day, Harney versus Speedway.